Welcome to the Bylines Network podcast. This week, we're going to do something a little different and revisit our webinar from last week, Democracy Under Fire, with Peter Dukes, Tom Brake, Clive Lewis, and Natalie Bennett, chaired by Louise Houghton, the Bylines Network coordinator. I'll hand over to Louise now to introduce the panelists. We hope that you enjoy the conversation.
Hello and welcome everyone to the second Bylines Network webinar. This one is entitled Democracy Under Fire. Tonight we have an excellent panel of speakers from the worlds of politics and journalism, and it's great to see so many of our writers and editors here tonight as well. Thank you for everything you're doing to make this all possible. Many of you will know or know of Mike Galsworthy from Scientists for EU. The Bylines Network came about following a conversation he had with Peter Dukes over a year ago, talking about the importance of participatory democracy and citizen journalism. This is something Peter is passionate about. So let me introduce our first speaker. Peter's an author, screenwriter, and co-founder of Byline Times and the Byline Festival. After 25 years as a playwright and screenwriter for mainstream TV dramas, he came to prominence as a journalist for his live tweeting of the phone hacking trial in 2013. He has written for The Observer, Independent, New York Times, New Republic, Politico, Daily Beast, and others. I should say that due to a fault in our system, we unfortunately didn't manage to record the beginning of Peter's talk, but we can pick it up just as he gets to the important part.
If the journalism is the immune system, if you like, of the body politic, when that gets corrupted, then you're prone to other infections. Now, the two things I think very quickly have corrupted us and corrupted the media is, I put them down to two words, which I think I stole from Stephen Kinnock. Anyway, I've been using them on Byline Times for the last 2 years, is dirty data and dark money. Dirty data, obviously, I'll get to Cambridge Analytica soon, but it's an ancient tradition of the press to be used as compromise, as hit jobs. You know, if you see back sort of Elizabethan times, actors stabbing each other because one had defamed them in a pamphlet. That is an old story. But what happens, particularly with Rupert Murdoch, but not only with him, is this gets industrialized. And then by the time you get to phone hacking, news the world. And this wasn't the only intelligence operation on New Labour, but during the noughties had 27 ministers and there were spads regularly hacked. This is a Stasi-like operation. And what is that information useful? Sometimes for the public interest, sometimes to expose some scandal, but generally for coercion, bullying, blackmail, and compromise. And if you look at the history of Murdoch, though he claims to be a free marketeer, basically games the regulator, he bullies politicians, he frightens them. And the epitome of this is it came out in the trial. People forget it wasn't a phone hacking trial alone, more trials about bribing public officials, was the black safe, the big safe that came out in the trial in Kingston, 7-foot-high safe in the Sun, which is called the Black Museum, which is filled of compromising materials and stuff that can never be published, but it's not in the public interest. But the threat of all those photographs, those documents, tapes of David Blunkett talking about his child were kept in these safes. And there's a classic story of Michael Wolff, the biographer. He made quite an unflattering portrait, but what Murdoch would say, they talk about a politician, anybody, go, we got a photograph of him. And so what happened, the withholding of information or the intrusion on privacy became standard practice. And long story behind this, Daniel Morgan murder, this panel report coming out, I urge you to listen to the podcast to understand where criminal media nexus, as Gordon Brown described it in 2011. But that was partly exposed by phone hacking. And to a certain extent, people didn't blackmail politicians over their phone messages anymore, or like happened to Chris Bryan, you know, this would have heard police officers, if somebody rang the station, I've been, been burgled or something's happened, the Sun would be there before the police officer. That has kind of gone, but something else in a way worse has replaced it. And that's obviously the dirty data of all the likes, dislikes, 3,000 points of information Chris Wiley described to me that particular organization, Cambridge Analytica, had on every voter in America. I was one of the victims of the Cambridge Analytica related app, which downloaded all my data, or even my direct messages to them. and Facebook never told me. So I'm part of a class action, representative action against them. But what that allowed you to do, you could predict famously, I'd get the figures wrong, but after 100 likes on Facebook, you could predict them better than their friends, 200 better than their partner, and around 300 better than them themselves. But that data, you mix it with electoral register, you mix that with song likes, your Spotify playlist. Chris Wiley told me this, you know, 6 months before it came out in The Observer, a terrifying vision of dirty data now being used to create a kind of private reality around individuals for targeted, it's not targeted advertising, it's targeted information. It's a fifth battle space, as Chris Wiley described it, which is the information space where you move the target into a different reality. We're seeing beyond Brexit, lots of signs on that now, obviously QAnon and the insurrection in the capital in January. You're also seeing it, I think, here with the scandemic movement and various other movements where actually this is where we are seeing our reality, our shared reality being broken down in a different way to how Rupert Murdoch would break down the reality of politicians. We are targeted by these ads. And as people notice, if they get on social media, a bit like Rupert Murdoch, they will be threatened, not by a tabloid press journalist knocking at the door, but somebody threatening. If you're a person of color on social media, the death threats or the vague threats, the doxing, all that is insuperable. The other thing, which is the dark money. So right from the beginning, the danger of the media always was it was a tool of rich men to change politics. It's only by about 1850 that you get an independent newspaper, which is funded by advertising, the Times. And that model has gone. So you could, in the high days of the Times, the Sunday Times under Harold Evans, the Observer, you know, the good days of the Express, the good days of the Mail, you could say that in a way, these media organizations were above political influence because they were funded by advertising, and advertisers have some pull, but you can always go to another advertiser. You see it go wrong with HSBC and the Telegraph. As why Peter Oborne left, they were big advertisers. The Telegraph wouldn't run his stories about HSBC. But by and large, that was quite a stable system for some kind of independence generally. But that's gone. Nobody makes any money in journalism anymore. All that advertising has been hoovered up, billions of it every year, by Facebook and Google, who don't produce news. So we're back to the problem of dark money. We constantly get, you know, who funds you, Jukes? Yeah, so, well, the audience do. We have 12,000, 13,000 subscribers, pay £36 a year. You can see, you know, the economics of this. But the expectation is that a rich person will pay to get their reality set. And we're seeing it now with something like GB News, 60 million on this new news channel, which has already said this challenging woke culture. Its early presenters do not look like they're providing any kind of balance, but they don't need to because they are funded by Sir Paul Marshall, who runs a hedge fund. I think he made about 200 million out of Brexit, and Pat Cording, he persuaded Gove to go for Brexit. And the rest of the money comes from Legatum, a capital fund based out of Dubai. A lot of the personnel are Australian. So this idea of GB News being a national news is slightly ludicrous. We have the problem of oligarchs moving into the media space, happened in Russia, happened in Ukraine, happened in Poland, happens in Congress. It's the first thing they do in the information economy is try to control the flow of information about them particularly and the reality around them. Murdoch kind of set this up. You know, he's not a British citizen. He was allowed to own the News of the World, then the Sun, and then allowed to take over the Times. So he had a monopoly position in Fleet Street, i.e. he had 40% of the circulation, 50% of the revenues, a price gouging monopoly situation without being a British citizen. To start up the Fox News Network, he had to become an American citizen. And that's why Reagan fast-tracked him. He had to sell the New York Post for a while because he wanted a TV station in New York. They have stringent laws against market abuse and monopoly power in the media sector. And without sounding xenophobic, I really don't understand why most of the papers are owned by non-domicile for tax purposes. I mean, just like a lot of Brexiteers left the shores, having pushed a Brexit and now moved to Europe, there is just a market failure. It's an externality that there is no consequences for their abuse of power. both that dark money and that dirty data, I think, together, especially in the digital space, is deeply corrosive of the shared reality. Even Biden talked about it, the shared truths. We need to organize a democracy.
Thank you, Peter. That's certainly from the Bylines Network perspective. We're definitely not funded and paid. We work very closely with Byline Times as well in trying to expose that and support the media in the country that is pushing for truth and justice. But it leads me nicely on to Tom Brake. Tom is the director of Unlock Democracy, was MP for Carshalton?
Carshalton, yeah.
And Wallington from 1997 to 2019, where he was active in pushing for democratic reform. This included extending freedom of information laws to private companies like Serco and Capita when they undertake work for the public sector. It also included defending UK elections from foreign interference and pushing for votes at 16. I don't know how much of that you'll cover today, but welcome, Tom, and thank you.
Thank you very much, Louise. I think Peter said that I was someone who stepped forward. Unfortunately, the last time I stepped forward in the general election, I was shot down by my electorate, but that's the way these things work. But I fell on my feet, and I'm very happy as the director of Unlock Democracy, an organisation that campaigns on issues that are very close to my heart. So the title of today was, Is Democracy Under Fire? And I want to draw an analogy between the state of a house and the state of our democracy. Some houses are condemned. I don't think our democracy is yet at that stage. Other houses are houses that are ready to be moved into, or perhaps just need a little bit of a makeover, perhaps ripping out those 70s orange and avocado bathrooms, for instance. That's not the state of our democracy. Our democracy, I think, is in the state of the houses that you see on that show, The Great House Giveaway. So it's a house that's been sold at auction, which has some major structural issues with it. That's not surprising, because if you look at our democracy, many aspects of it are, like many of our housing stock, 70 years old. The services are 70 years old, and the roof is beginning to leak a little bit, and there's a bit of subsidence. And I think that is a fit description for our democracy. So if you take, for instance, First Past the Post, well, First Past the Post really probably dates back to 1950. And what's interesting is that actually before 1950, some members of Parliament were elected under an STV system. Astonishing for the UK. And it dispels the myth, for instance, that we couldn't possibly do something like STV because we have this tradition of First Past the Post. Well, First Past the Post actually only exists since 1950. And prior to that, there were seats, as I said, that were elected under STV. As I guess everyone on this call know, unfortunately, our system of First Past the Post is one that we, along with other things, exported to our empire. Sensibly, many of those countries have moved on, but we haven't. New Zealand and Australia, for instance, have moved on. Unfortunately, others haven't, but certainly we haven't. We're still very much stuck with that system. And House of Lords, in its present form, dates back to 1911, the point at which the House of Lords could no longer reject legislation. But really, it hasn't undergone much change since then. Certainly, the sort of contradiction in terms, that is, the election of hereditary peers, hardly counts as a substantial reform of the House of Lords. Those are the services that are, I think, corroded within the house that is our democracy. Now, at this point, the house analogy falls down a little bit, because I now need to briefly touch on dark money, which is something that Peter talked about. Clearly, that's not something that has necessarily been around, certainly not in terms of funding that's going into things like Facebook ads, hasn't been around for 70 years, but is worth briefly touching on that. I was been doing some work with Open Democracy and The Mirror. The Mirror and Open Democracy have been looking at the non-party organisations that funded to the tune of £700,000 of adverts, Facebook adverts, against Jeremy Corbyn was their target. And I think what was interesting for me is that as the government minister who was responsible for bringing forward aspects of the transparency a non-party lobbying bill, which, I mean, I have differences of opinion with some of the charity sector and so on about the intent of that. But one thing that was very clear about that act is that it was trying to stop the development of the super PACs that you see in the US. That was the purpose of the bill. I was the minister. That is what I was trying to achieve through that. Looking back at the notes from that bill, it was very clear that the expectation, for instance, was that the only organizations that would not be receiving donations of £700,000 or more, the only ones that wouldn't receive donations of that size, were going to be small organizations. And those are the organizations, therefore, that wouldn't have to report their donations. But some of these organizations that I talked about that collectively spent £700,000 on Facebook ads were spending £60,000-£65,000 per organization. And they're not small organizations, yet not a single one of those 12, I think it was, declared a single donation above £7,500. Now, as someone who fought 8 general elections, and Clive and possibly Natalie will be familiar with this, if you're trying to raise a significant sum of money to fight an election campaign, particularly if you are doing it in the last 3 months before the election, which is what these organizations were doing, you don't raise £60,000 from £5 here and there. You tend to raise it from large donations. And the fact that £700,000 managed to be raised without a single donation over £7,500, frankly, I don't believe to be true. And that's why, working with Open Democracy and the Mirror, we have contacted the Electoral Commission and asked them to investigate it, because we simply don't believe that this is true. And certainly it wasn't expected that that would happen when this bill was being debated sort of 10 years ago or so. So just to come to a conclusion, in terms of what we need to do to get this massive reconstruction project underway in terms of our democracy, well, we need to do the same sort of thing that needs to happen in relation to the restoration and renewal project for the Palace of Westminster, which is to start with the foundations. And incidentally, if that project doesn't start soon, there's a real risk that our Palace of Westminster will burn down. And I think that, from our democracy's point of view, whilst perhaps some might join the crowds on the Thames riverbank to acclaim the burning down of our parliament, I suspect that actually for our democracy, it would not be a particularly good image. So we need to start with the foundations, and that means a fair voting system, and first past the post clearly wouldn't qualify in that respect. It means reform of the House of Lords. And again, the way in which that's done, that would be something that perhaps through a deliberative process, citizens' assembly, that the public would draw their own conclusions about what type of reform to the House of Lords. But an unelected House of Lords clearly would not be acceptable. More transparency and accountability of government. Some of you will have read that the government are proposing setting up this special agency with public money, ARIA, as it's called. They're going to spend £800 million of taxpayers' money on setting up this public organisation, and they are going to exclude it from the list of bodies subject to FOI. And I can only draw one conclusion as to why they're going to do this, and that is because we know that Dominic Cummings was suggesting that huge amounts of taxpayers' money should be spent on a company that wanted to place satellites in low orbit to replace a system that we're going to lose as a result of leaving the European Union. And all the evidence points to the fact that that is going to be a huge financial black hole and will not provide the technical benefits that one would expect. And I can only suppose that the government are going to use this agency to bring forward the latest pet project that a minister or a special advisor might have, and don't want it to be subject to any scrutiny. And that's £800 million worth of taxpayers' money that will not be open to scrutiny. So we need a fair voting system, transparency and accountability of government. That means, for instance, that the Prime Minister, who has failed to enforce the ministerial code, it cannot be left in his hands. And incidentally, it suffers a major lacuna, which is that the ministerial code applies to the Prime Minister, and therefore the Prime Minister would be expected to apply the ministerial code to himself if he was in breach of it. And clearly, it's very unlikely that he would want to do that. So accountability means the ministerial code can't be left in the control of the Prime Minister. deliberative democracy will be key to this in terms of improving the trust, I think, that exists between the public and politicians. Devolution, some work that Unlock Democracy are paying for from one of our universities, is looking at how local authorities have seen their powers reduced over the last 40 years and what impact that has had on our local democracy. And finally, my final sort of few words about the written constitution. Now, if we overhaul that rather dilapidated house in the way that I describe, in terms of a new roof, proper services, deal with the subsidence, then what you need at the end of that process is a written guarantee that that house is going to stay in that condition thereafter. And that is where the written constitution comes in. So it guarantees things like that the fair voting system would remain. It guarantees things like that the House of Lords would be an elected chamber. It guarantees that no Prime Minister could ever come forward and propose shutting down Parliament against Parliament's will. So that is what the written constitution would do, provide that guarantee. And that and the other issues that I've talked about are the sorts of issues that Unlock Democracy campaigns on. And thank you for giving me the chance this evening to set out what we're up to as an organisation.
That's wonderful. Thank you, Tom. It's brought lots of questions for me. I want to know all about what you think about voter ID that's being proposed, about local elections coming up this year and the COVID rules and how that will impact little parties. But thank you very much, Tom. And I'd like to introduce Clive, who probably doesn't need a lot of introduction, but I am anyway. So Clive is a Labour MP from Norwich South. Prior to that, he's been vice president of the National Union of Students. You see, these are things I didn't know.
Long time ago. That.
last year, he was president of the National Union of Students, vice president,
BBC TV, where you've gone far.
Political reporter, and an Army Reservist Infantry officer serving a combat tour in Afghanistan in 2009. Clive is chair of the APPG, or the All Party Parliamentary Group on Race and Community, and co-chair of the APPG's on Green New Deal and Future of Work.
Thank you very much. I really, really appreciate that. And it's lovely to be here tonight to take part in this. And I'm going to talk broadly about the crisis of democracy. And I don't know whether I'll disagree with anyone. Maybe I'll disagree as to some of the kind of the urgency. But I think we're all kind of singing from the same hymn sheet. So the theme today is democracy under fire. But I would say maybe it's more accurate to say democracy is on fire. A torch is being taken to what are very modest and limited democratic gains that have been made in the last couple of hundred years in this country. Now, if I'm being honest, I look around and I see too many progressives in my party, in other parties, and in the wider social movement turning up to the blazing inferno with a watering can, and some aren't showing up at all. And I think we need to get real about the challenges before us, the systemic change demanded, and the collective action required. Now, if we can't do that, then I'm afraid to say that we're probably going to be left squabbling over ashes. I don't mean to be too dramatic, but I think, you know, given, as I will explain in the talk, where we are, I think this is quite accurate. So what I want to offer tonight for your consideration is a diagnosis of why the health of our democracy is ailing. And we need to get this right so we can prepare and deliver the right antidote. And I'm going to spend, you know, the next 10 minutes or so that I have talking about the nature of the democratic crisis as I see it, and the democratic transformation that I think is proportionate to the scale of the challenge. So some of you may have heard me speak before as an advocate of proportional representation and codified constitution, but I'm not. I didn't come into politics because I had a burning desire to see a wider variety of coloured rosettes at elections. The aspiration of being able to wave around a hard copy of a written down constitution is not what gets me out of bed in the morning, if I'm being really honest. In fact, if that's all I managed to achieve during my time as an elected representative, I consider it a failure. For me, the motivation to come into politics was to defend the very moderate gains already made, such as social housing, comprehensive schooling, and higher education as a public good, and build on them for a deeper transformative structural change. Elections and codified documents can only ever be parts of a whole. Important parts, sure. I wouldn't be here talking about Democracy Day if it was otherwise. But democracy at its very core is about giving people power in both their everyday lives as well as in the workplace. And for me, that means political and economic power, the power to participate and make decisions about the issues that affect you in politics, in the workplace. The two are indivisible. And we are in a crisis of democracy because our institutions and systems have failed people. It doesn't start with Boris Johnson or Brexit. It doesn't even start with the financial crisis of 2008, the expenses scandal, or the Iraq war. So let's not mistake symptoms for causes. I think that the cause is fundamentally that our political system was not set up to function as a democracy. Democratic features have been stapled onto this elective dictatorship, as a former Conservative Lord Chancellor, Lord Hailsham, called it. You know, he's not exactly a radical socialist. He's a member of the establishment, but even he could see what it was. Therefore, I think that the nature of this democratic crisis means that we must collectively prioritize the transformation of the whole instead of tinkering at the edges. So allow me to set out what I think the bigger picture here really is. The threats facing humanity this century are existential. Lord Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal, considers himself an optimist when it comes to the future. He put our chances of surviving this century at 50-50. If these were your odds going into the surgery, you'd probably have your winning order, and you'd probably have said your goodbyes to your nearest and dearest. The pandemic has been devastating. We're living through it now. Over 1 million people around the world have died. Millions more have been infected, and many are living with long-term health conditions. Existing inequalities have been entrenched, both domestically and internationally, while public procurement has become a get-rich-quick scheme for the government's cronies. We're also in the middle of an ecological breakdown, which scientists have linked to the emergence of COVID-19. Biodiversity is collapsing. Our food chains are collapsing, and many species have been wiped out or on the brink of extinction. This is made worse by the climate crisis. And even though the cause has now been known for decades, there has been an international failure to take the action required because of the mass consumerism and deregulation demanded by free market ideology, which puts profiteering before public good. We're also experiencing the rise of AI and surveillance capitalism, where democracy is seen by big tech companies as an obstacle to competing with Chinese firms, which benefit from the Chinese state's lax regulations. This is the crisis of democracy, because at the heart of these problems is the failure of our established institutions and political system as a whole to represent the public, to challenge economic self-interest in favor of the common good. The economic liberalization of the last 40 years, actually, let's scrap that. Let's call it what it is. A deliberate and systemic uncoupling of democratic will over the economy and our collective ability to control the power of capital. But how else can we explain the phenomena of so-called liberal democracies destroying the very life support system that keeps us alive simply to enrich a small minority? Makes no sense. In fact, there's a valid argument to be made that we never really had complete democratic control over these vested interests in some mythical age past. What we've had is merely a sliding scale of the illusion of control. Once the climate and ecological crisis has blown a vast hole through. It's therefore clear to me the past 40 years has gone hand in hand with a retreat of even our limited democracy. And this has brought about a new gilded age and the mass accumulation of wealth and power, and that power is increasingly unaccountable. Peter himself earlier touched upon how, via information and data, they're attempting to hold on to that power and entrench that power. So this brings to me the basic definition of a progressive, someone I can work with to take on those vested interests, irrelevant of the party or the background. And it's this: do you believe in more democracy, not less? And are you prepared to reduce, not manage, but reduce the power of capital? If yes to both answers, then I think we can do business. And I think that's a pretty broad, and given the cliff edges we face, a pretty inclusive definition. And this is why the only answer to the democratic crisis for me is democratic transformation that will lead to an inevitable economic one. And that is a bigger picture where I see creating a new constitution for the UK and changing our electoral system fitting in. Because there's nothing about having a codified constitutional proportional representation that will create the transformed democracy I think we need. Yes, writing and codifying a new constitution is a basic requirement for democracy. But this process, done democratically and harnessing tech for good, is also an opportunity to think about the kind of state we need to meet the challenges we face. What kind of state do we want as a vehicle for equality and freedom for all? How we redistribute and decentralize power, including how to remedy the present implications of the UK's colonial past. And yes, proportional representation is the way we realize the basic requirement for fair and equal votes. But we must also see this as an opportunity to renew our political culture, to deepen collaboration, consensus building, and inclusivity, and to make sure that in responding to the challenges we face, those who are systematically excluded, alienated, and discriminated against by our current institutions are put in the driving seat. So how do we bring about this democratic transformation in the face of such enormous challenges? I think we need to get out of the 19th century party political silos that aren't fit for the 21st century challenges. That's why I look to the Road 2024. It was one that must be paved by electoral pacts and the building and formation of progressive alliances. And I say this to those in my party, if anyone here tonight is listening to this, that must mean giving up the aspiration held by some to impose socialism from above and moving beyond Labourism, that ridiculous idea that the Labour Party is the only vehicle for progressive change. For those of a liberal persuasion, that means confronting an instinct to think of democracy in terms of merely institutions and representation alone. So very quickly to conclude, I'm going to finish by saying that I think there's a very clear choice in front of those of us who want to see a democratic future. Either we start working together, we identify areas of common cause that will form the basis of an electoral pact that will elect a progressive government at the next election and open up the way for a radical and transformative democratic and economic change. Or we can pin our hopes on the failed political system of the 20th century, producing the solutions to the problems that it created in the first place.
Wow. Thank you, Clive. That's cheered me up. I would like to work with you, most certainly. And it is certainly what we're trying to achieve from the Bylines Network, which is apolitical, cross-political. We bring in everyone from the progressive sphere. And if we have your definition of do you want more democracy and reduce the power of capital, we might just have to change our logo for the Bylines Network and just get everyone to sign up to say yes. But I think you've set the scene nicely for our final speaker, Natalie Bennett. So as a quick introduction for you, Natalie, Natalie is a lifelong Green and feminist. She is we wrote this for you, you didn't write this, so you might want to, again, write a reply. She's the leader of the Green Party from 2012 to 2016 and is now a member of the House of Lords. Natalie was editor of the Guardian Weekly from 2007 to 2012. She is currently co-chair of the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Hong Kong. Born and raised in Australia, she began her career as a journalist with regional papers back in New South Wales. Over to you, Natalie.
Well, thank you very much, Louise. And no, that's absolutely right. Although I think in joining Tom and Clive in congratulating the Bylines Network in its growth and rapid expansion, I might add to that that I've just looked it up. I started being a blogger in July 2004. And the first time I actually appeared on national television, it just happened to flash past. I saw the blog post on it. It was April 24, 2006. And it wasn't for the Green Party. It was on Sky Television. They had this hour-long show where they talked to this weird new species called bloggers. And every time they introduced bloggers, they had to define what a blogger was. So I'm sure, you know, that will seem like ancient history, and it feels like ancient history to lots of your contributors, but that's some of the early history of things that led towards Bylines. But when I was invited onto this panel, I thought there was something of a risk that these panels, sometimes it's all people agreeing with each other. But I'm glad to see that we've got a gradation here. And I am going to start by, to some degree, disagreeing with what both Tom and Clive have said to start off with. Tom said we've got to fix our democracy. And Clive said we have a limited democracy, or we have democratic features buttoned onto what's essentially a feudal system. I would say the UK is not a democracy. And I evolved towards that through spending many years going to public meetings as Green Party leader, saying to people variations of what Tom and Clive just said, oh, our democracy's broken, we've got to fix it. And then eventually it struck me one day that actually, if we take the last election, 2019, the Conservative Party got 44% of the vote and 100% of the power. And that does not fit a democracy by any definition. And if you also look at the way in which London, well, actually, Sean Berry will be after me when I say London. Westminster dominates the rest of the country. And it is Westminster, you know, the parliament there. Let's not blame the people of Tower Hamlets or the people of Southeast London. Westminster dominates the rest of the country so much that people have no real say about what happens, about where houses are built in their community. So the UK is not a democracy. And picking up the House of Lords point, I went into the House of Lords with the explicit intention of abolishing my own job as soon as possible. One of the first things I did was actually, after I made my maiden speech, was go up to the bill office holding my elections and other reforms House of Lords bill. So just to sort of finish off on our metaphor and come round in a circle with Tom said, you know, what sort of house was it like? Well, I think we're more like a sort of Norman Moton Bailey castle. The peasants have been drafted in to chuck up to build that mound, and they've stuck a wooden structure on top, and that's about what we've got in terms of our non-democracy. And you know, there's so much we need to change. But one of the things, one of the real challenges is how do we go about it? And I think bouncing off of what Clive was saying, you know, COVID is a product of our ecological crisis, what we've done to the planet. But what we also need to do while seeing all the tragedy, the disaster, the suffering, is seeing that COVID has taught us is one lesson, which is it's possible to change things really, really quickly. It's possible to make massive sudden changes in ways that no one predicted weeks or months beforehand. And I think we need to take that as a positive sign. And, you know, people say, oh, you know, oh, it's going to take so long. And, you know, maybe we can elect a parliament in 2024 that will be a PR majority parliament. And we gradually, you know, but we have a profoundly broken system. I was once at a meeting, actually, with Make Votes Matter with someone from the Electoral Reform Society who, you know, has been around for a very long while and kind of might be described as rather fixed in his ways. And this was a few years ago now. And he was saying, oh, you know, I think we've really got to wait for the political crisis, and then we've got to have exactly the right system all worked out to present with a political crisis. And there's probably some marks underneath the chair where I was hanging onto the chair, restraining myself from going, political crisis, what do you think we're in now? But a political crisis. And that was a few years ago, and we're still very clearly continuing that political crisis. One of the books that I always recommend to people is a great little book by a professor called Stein Ringen, Nation of Devils. And it was written about a dozen years or so ago now, and basically said the US and the UK are not democracies and they're more or less ungovernable in their current structures. And I'd have to say that looks like a pretty prescient book to have written a dozen years ago. And one of the other interesting things, and again, this is lessons from COVID, one of the things he points out is that not only is a first-past-the-post system, a majoritarian system, profoundly undemocratic, it also produces just objectively a really lousy quality of governance. The quality of decision-making that you're making, independent of whatever the ideology is just really, really poor. And one of the reasons for that is you have a seesaw situation. So you have a Labour government brings in, say, a whole lot of Shawsart centres. You have a Tory government whose main aim is to undo everything the Labour government did. And they go in the other direction. All those people who built up those centres, who learnt those skills, all that infrastructure is lost. And you see that also with the extreme of that with Donald Trump, who, if there was one coherent part of Donald Trump's ideology, it was to undo everything that Obama had ever done. And that's the one coherent line that you can run through the whole of Trump. So we can deliver change. And, you know, the real question is how. And I want to devote a couple of minutes to that, because I do believe that Q&A and dialogue is better than monologue. So I'll try not to monologue for too long. But the chief message I'd ask everyone to take away, and I, way I feel like I don't have to say this to this audience, but let's really pin it down. I say this when I talk to schools and colleges and universities and old picture groups or anything. My top line of message is politics should be what you do, not have done to you. If you're a Bylines contributor or thinking about being a Bylines contributor, if you're reporting what's happening in your local community, what's happening in your area, what you see happening around you, that's doing politics. But doing politics can be you, even simpler than that. Organising a litter pick, socially distanced litter pick now, saying this is our public space, we want to look after it. That's a political action. When I'm taking you to schools and people say, oh, you're saying do politics, what do you mean? And I say to the pupils, right, well, get together, sit down with your friends and see what you don't like about how the schools run and then start a campaign to change it. At which point the teacher who invited me goes, oh, what have I done? But this is what we have to do, is empower everyone to get involved and engaged. And that's why one of the really exciting things that's happening is we're seeing a huge rise in participatory democracy, citizens' assemblies. We had the climate assembly that unfortunately sort of got swept aside in terms of coverage by COVID. But there's huge numbers of assemblies coming up in local communities. And this idea of participatory democracy, deliberative democracy, not just a simple referendum where you vote on an impossibly complicated question with a yes or no answer, but where you have a representative group of people from around the country or around the region, wherever it is in your city, even in your suburb, representative group of people by age, by gender, by BME background, all the rest of it, get them together, give them the knowledge, give them the information, give them the chance to talk each other and discuss. And it's really being proven to work really well as a decision-making method. And, you know, what I would say is, how do we draw up the new written constitution? And I very much agree with Clive that we need a written constitution, although my argument is perhaps a little bit different, because I think there are so many ridiculous aspects of our current constitution. you know, The Guardian's just been highlighting again the way in which the Queen and the heir to the throne actually have an incredibly large impact on legislation, despite their supposedly purely ceremonial role. If you wrote down, the heir to the throne shall have the right to scribble in spidery black ink all over every bit of legislation before anyone else sees it, if you wrote that down, the ink would fly off the page in incredulity. If you wrote down our current constitution, people would just laugh. So we need a people's constitutional convention, a genuinely representative group of people. We could have a whole national conversation on social media. That's where the blogging in the Bylines Network comes back in. Have a huge conversation on social media. The country discusses, decides what our new constitution should look like, how we get a functional government system. We come together and we create that change. And I can't tell you exactly how that's going to happen, but it's crucially important that it does, because I would say that, you know, our side of politics broadly, our progressive side of politics, needs, wants, encourages people to be empowered to feel like they can take control of their own lives. The other side, the far right, wants people to feel disempowered, beaten down, so that the person, the leader, comes riding up on the big white horse and everyone just follows them along and they lead them wherever the person on the horse leads to. And that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about everyone being involved, engaged, and having a say. And that, I would say, is democracy. It's nothing like what we have now, but it's something that we have to work to. And, you know, if you invite me to come and talk about algae, if you invite me to talk about climate change or the biodiversity crisis, I will come back to democracy, because the answers to poverty, to inequality, all of it ultimately comes back to democracy. Thanks very much.
Many thanks to all of our panellists for speaking at Democracy Under Fire. If you like what you heard, be sure to subscribe. Our music was Foxhole Revolution by Kevin MacLeod. Thanks for listening.